temperatures remain above a particular threshold. According to the US EPA, North Americans today are exposed to less dioxins than in the 1960s and 70s. The amount of dioxin in the average person's body has declined by more than 50% since the late 1980s. For people who might be living near contaminated waste sites, however, dioxins remain a danger, and ongoing efforts are required to ensure their proper cleanup. These aren't chemicals you want near you. Well, that's the wrap for this week's show. Thanks for joining me. We'll be back at the same time next week. As ever, a big thanks to Mike McNichol, our show producer extraordinaire. And if you can't wait a whole week for more environmental news, check us out on Twitter, Facebook, or at our website, terrainforma.ca. Bye for now.
Action Read Community Literacy Center is looking for new volunteer tutors. 4 out of 10 people aged 16 to 65 struggle with reading, writing, math, and other essential skills. Many adults here in Guelph are looking for support in reading job postings, calculating budgets, applying for benefits, and participating in community life. Action Read tutors are trained to help adults work from their current skills to reach their goals in work, learning, and life. If you can spare a couple of hours a week for the next year, you can make a big difference working one-on-one with an adult learner. Action Read has a terrific suite of tools and resources and a wealth of experience to help new tutors develop their skills teaching math, reading, writing, and computer basics. For more information or to volunteer, call 519-836-2759. That's 519-836-2759, or visit us online at actionread.com.
La 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 la, bam 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 bam, ba bam bam, my God, na 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 na.
You are listening to Crazy Luke on CFRU 93.3 FM.
Oh my God! Hi, ha hi, ha 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 hi, ma 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 ma.
You're listening to Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service, produced at the University of Ottawa. Stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM.
Today on Wings, plaintiffs challenging prostitution laws as violations of Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
3 years ago, Amy Leibovich, Valerie Scott, and Terry Jean Bedford filed a charter challenge against three laws that criminalize sex work in Ontario. The act of purchasing sex is not illegal in Canada, but there are existing laws to criminalize communicating for the purposes of prostitution, pimping, and living off the avails. On September 28, 2010, Justice Susan Himmel struck down these laws, but then it was immediately appealed by the government. Amy Leibovich, one of the plaintiffs in the case, explains the laws that are being challenged and how they adversely affect sex workers.
So Section 210, which is one of the laws in the criminal code that we were challenging, what that spoke to was the body house. So working by yourself, out of your own home, working with other people from your home, a rented space, a hotel, a motel, that sort of thing. And so obviously one of the main problems with that law is for people that do have housing and are able to work indoors, they are either afraid of eviction based on being a sex worker, being found out, working with more than one person. So if you have sort of a bunch of people working together, like a co-op, you can be charged with keeping a common body house. So 212 of the criminal code, we were actually challenging 1J, which prohibits living wholly or in part on the avails of prostitution. And essentially what this law says is anyone that lives wholly or in part off of our earnings. So that could include our partners, if we have someone that we live with who might have a part-time job or don't work. It can also include people that we would have to keep us safe or work with us, employees, receptionists, security, someone that is our driver, etc.
Right.
So that's section 212.1J. Just briefly, that's one of the main reasons we were challenging that law, because it directly attacks the people that are working to keep sex workers safe, right?
Yeah.
And helping us with our work, and also our live-in partners if we have one.
Right, or even elderly family members.
Yep. And can even go as far as to say nannies that look after our kids, right? And removing this law is not going to change the fact that people that are living off of sex workers parasitically who are using us in a negative way, that is still against the law.
Cynthia Peterson, the lawyer representing Maggie's Empower, two sex worker organizations, clarified how striking down the living off the avails provision would not permit those looking to live off of sex workers parasitically to do so.
The criminal code has many provisions relating to prostitution, and only three of them are being challenged in this particular case. So there are provisions that deal with trafficking, for example, that deal with inducements to essentially coerce women into sex work when it's not something that they want to do voluntarily, or to keep them in sex work if it's not something that they want to do. It includes, you know, provisions challenging child sex work, and not just trafficking, but child prostitution. None of those laws are being challenged. So even if the case is successful from our perspective and the three provisions are struck down, that doesn't mean that, you know, men who traffic in women, for example, are going to be at liberty to do so without any fear of criminal sanction. There are other laws that will maintain, you know, sort of criminal sanctions for that type of behavior.
Amy Lebovich then went on to continue explaining the provisions that they were challenging.
And so the third law is communicating. So that's section 213.1C. And what that prohibited was communicating for the purpose of prostitution. So soliciting clients in a public place.
Right.
Outdoors, sort of the first thing that comes to people's minds. Cell phones as well. The internet. Other sort of outdoor locations or places open to the public. So for my colleagues that work on the street, primarily this law really affected them negatively because they were being arrested, charged with communicating. So to not be arrested, they're working alone. They are making judgment calls very quickly, getting into people's cars quickly for fear of the police, working in areas that are unlit and unpopulated. So this law is very important for us to challenge as well. And the law, the solicitation law, really is not, if you look at it, is not meant to protect us. It's really for the neighborhood, the nuisance of us being on the street. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That's really what the law was enacted for, not for our safety, right? So as far as that is concerned, you know, discussion can happen with neighborhoods and people that are concerned about it, but this law clearly was not keeping those who work on the street safe.
The appeal took place from June 14th to 17th at the Supreme Court of Ontario. Sandra Calhoun-Chu from the Canadian HIV and AIDS Legal Network gives us the breakdown of what was happening in court that week.
I attended the 4 days of hearings. Yeah. So the first day was the Attorney General for Canada, and they basically said that the laws aren't the cause of the harm, that it's violent pimps and predators, I think was their language, that are causing the harms. And they made a number of different arguments. And the second day was the Attorney General of the province of Ontario, many of the arguments revolved around the objective of the law. And at the trial level, the judge said the objective of the law is to prevent nuisance. One of the many objectives, but the main objective is to prevent nuisance. And this is not really doing its job. And so the Attorney General of Ontario tried to reframe it as the objective was to discourage and deter prostitution because it's inherently harmful. It's degrading towards women, I think was their argument. So to reframe it as a broader objective makes it more likely that that the law is achieving its objective, because it's such a vague objective, right? It's hard to argue that it isn't achieving its objective. Which Alan Young's team, who represented the applicants in the case, said that wasn't the case, that was never the objective of the law. It was basically a nuisance issue. And then the fourth day was interveners, which was when my organization was able to present its arguments along with the other interveners in the case.
Although Justice Himmel ruled that these laws were unconstitutional and violated the human rights of sex workers, these laws were stayed while the government appealed the decision. Fred Chatbot, a member of POWER, an Ottawa-based sex workers organization that intervened in this case, discusses their position as well as the other interveners.
So interveners are stakeholders who have something to add to the case or have a position on the ruling and would have to add their argument to the entire case that is already existent. So who was intervening in this case was, well, there was us, so POWER, who's a sex worker rights group, and then we paired up with Maggie's sex worker rights group in Toronto. Then there was Downtown Eastside Sex Workers Against Violence, with paired up with Pivot and PACE. And then HIV/AIDS Legal Network and the BC Centre for Excellence on HIV/AIDS Policy. So they argued that the criminal code sections make it nearly impossible for sex workers to implement harm reduction strategies or to access harm reduction strategies in regards to HIV and AIDS and other STIs. The Christian Fellowship was an intervener. They wanted to talk about the moral fabric of Canada, same for Real Women of Canada. There was a coalition of radical feminist groups who stand for the abolition of prostitution, so they also had something they wanted to add to this whole case and argue.
The Radical Women's Coalition that Fred was referring to consisted of the Canadian Association of Sexual Assault Centres, the Native Women's Association of Canada, the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, Action Ontarienne contre les Violences Faites aux Femmes, La Concertation de Lutte contre l'Exploitation Sexuelle, le Regroupement Québécois du Centre d'Aide et de Lutte contre les Agressions à Caractère Sexuel, and the Vancouver Rape Relief Society. Fred went on to discuss the process of becoming an intervener in this case and the preparation of their factum.
We applied to be interveners in the Bedford versus Canada appeal, which was happening last week. We got picked up. The whole application process was happening in January, and then since January, when we learned that we were actually being considered to be interveners, we've been working hard with lawyers in Ottawa and also in Toronto to develop our factum, so basically our what we wanted to add to this court case in terms of arguments.
Fred was present during the appeal hearing, which took place from June 13th to 17th, 2011. I asked her about how things went that week.
It was wonderful to be able to witness what feels like a historic moment. There's a conversation about sex workers' rights that is happening Canada-wide. Obviously, people are getting interested in it because of the battle that's happening in court. So it was really great to be there and to support the applicants, so the three sex workers who have challenged the laws. And it was awesome to just be there and be a presence there and witness the lawyers do their submissions. It was very, very engaged, all parties. The judges did remark at the end of the week how rare it is to have interveners that are so engaged with the topic and have prepared so thoroughly. So it was quite amazing to watch people speak during that week. It was also very emotional for everyone. Obviously, for a lot of people, it's a very personal issue. So to see it debated and to see some of the parties, in my opinion, argue really difficult things to hear for a lot of sex workers and their advocates. So it was very emotionally charged. So we were there. We were speaking on Thursday. Well, I say we, but it's our team of lawyers was speaking on Thursday. So Thursday was the day where all the interveners were speaking. So I have to say, for me, that day, we did the best that we could have done. Our lawyer who was speaking, Cynthia Peterson, she's the lawyer who worked on the Jane Doe case and the gay marriage. She's obviously a very seasoned human rights lawyer. She is amazing. The process of working with her was awesome. It was very collaborative. She was very open. She wanted a lot of consultation to be done with our Maggies and our membership, and she was very sensitive to what we thought was really important to have argued in court, and she did a stellar submission. She was, I believe, the best lawyer of all that week. Obviously, I'm slightly biased, but I think she was absolutely stellar, and same for Pivot. Katrina Pacey from Pivot was arguing for the Downtown Eastside Sex Workers United Against Violence. And she did a wonderful job as well. So, it was a wonderful day. It was awesome to hear the factum that we've been working on for so many months being presented to the judges.
Cynthia Peterson.
We wanted to take the argument even further and talk about two additional things. One is that it not only interferes with people's safety and security of the person, but it also interferes with personal autonomy, which is a constitutionally recognized right. And that's really the decision to make important decisions about your body and your bodily integrity and your psychological integrity. And so they wanted to argue, and we did argue in court, that it's not just a safety concern. There's also issues around people's personal autonomy. And also both Maggie's and Power wanted to bring, I think, an important equality perspective to the court and to point out that the people who are being denied safe working conditions, the sex workers who are denied safe working conditions and whose personal autonomy is being infringed, are predominantly women, disproportionately Aboriginal women, disproportionately racialized women. Many are women who are transsexual. Many are women who have struggled with poverty or who have disabilities. And so, and the men who are engaged in sex work are disproportionately gay or bisexual. And so there is an equality component to these laws as well, in that the adverse impact that's felt by the laws is felt by communities that are already quite marginalized and vulnerable. And we thought it was important to take that argument to the court as well.
You're listening to Wings, the Women's International News Gathering Service, produced at the University of Ottawa. Stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM.
The appeal was heard in front of a 5-judge panel, and it will probably take 6 months to a year before any decision is reached. In the meantime, sex workers are still subject to these provisions.
I understand the process, so obviously, I understand that it will take a long time for the judges to write their decision, especially since they were five. Usually, If it's a smaller case, there are three judges. This time there are five. I got different feelings of judges' positions on the matter, so I'm sure they'll have a lot of work to do in terms of writing a decision for this. So I'm not expecting it to come out before Christmas. Like, it's probably going to be between Christmas and in a year. But personally, I find it really upsetting that it takes so long and the laws are stayed in the meantime, because it's going to affect so many people's lives. And I mean, these laws contribute to so much violence experienced by sex workers, especially street-based sex workers, that for me, it's on the offensive side that we're keeping these laws in the meantime, when there's so much evidence that shows that they contribute to the violence and the vulnerability to violence.
I also asked Fred to comment on the Conservative government's position that the state was not responsible for the health and safety of those choosing to engage in sex work.
Well, that position was completely destroyed by the judges in court. It wasn't received very well, but for me, it was very upsetting to hear that, because it just shows how citizens in Canada are divided in different categories, and some are not considered deserving of that protection of the state. Actually, the state contributes to the violence that is done to them. One thing that our lawyer actually said during the submission that I thought was really powerful is that Cynthia, our lawyer, told the court that not only is sex work not valued in society, sex workers are not valued. I mean, sex work is kind of a concept. Like, the actual people who are on the receiving end of those statements and those laws and that position from the government are sex workers themselves, right? So to put it bluntly, she said, nobody cares, the state doesn't care, and it's reflected in these laws, and it's reflected in the position they adopted in this court case. So that's what I think about Harper's government position. I think it's important for people to educate themselves around the difference between legalization and decriminalization and the countries that have favored these models, because it's going to become a very important discussion in the next years, since we're heading to Supreme Court with this. So to look at New Zealand and the reports that are coming out in terms of the impact of decriminalizing sex work in that country, how to be allies with sex workers who are demanding decriminalization. LGBT groups and communities have been very powerful allies of sex workers. So just to the importance of the work that's being done around that, and the connections that are being made, and having a social justice approach to figuring out how we want to kind of deal with sex work in our country and what it means to do that.
Sandra Calhoun Chu, a senior policy analyst with the Canadian HIV and AIDS Legal Network, spoke about their consultation process and research findings in preparation for this case.
We found evidence that outreach workers who distribute lube and condoms and other safer sex materials and literature were having a hard time accessing sex workers, because they're being policed so heavily that they're not, in places that it's easy for outreach workers to get in touch with them. The communicating provision in the criminal code, which prevents people from communicating in public for the purpose of prostitution, there's a lot of evidence that was presented that was about how it prevents sex workers from screening clients. And what we said was, like, that's a huge harm to sex workers, but it also prevents you from negotiating the terms of what you're willing to do and whether you're willing to practice safer sex. So there's evidence that condom use is less likely to be enforced if you're not able to talk about it beforehand. We also said that preventing people from working indoors makes it also harder to enforce condom use, because there was some evidence at the trial record on that issue that indoor sex workers, they're more able to enforce condom use and other forms of safer sex.
Sandra then went on to talk about their position as interveners.
We didn't want to intervene and raise the whole specter of sex workers being vectors of disease, because we know that's happened before.
Yeah.
So we really wanted to frame it, and we do see it as a rights issue. It's a right to engage in the safer sex protection that we all should, all sexually active people should. One issue that we've consulted with colleagues at Maggie's and at Stella, we talked about, because one thing we definitely didn't want to be a response was, let's do mandatory testing, which has been in some jurisdictions.
Mandatory testing has been part of the legalization model in Nevada, Austria, and other parts of Europe. Sandra went on to discuss how mandatory testing poses further health risks for sex workers and violates their human rights.
When you have mandatory testing, it actually makes it less safe because clients just think, okay, we're not going to wear a condom anymore because, you've been tested, you're fine, you don't have a sexually transmissible infection. And that, puts a sex worker at risk because, the client's not necessarily not going to pass on an infection, right? So it's bad from a human rights perspective and it's bad from a public health perspective. So we encourage everybody to get voluntarily tested, but we would never, ever recommend mandatory testing.
Sandra also discussed why striking down the communicating provision is especially important for street-based sex workers.
There was a coalition of sex worker organizations from Vancouver who talked about how these provisions benefit sex workers on the street. Because one thing that I don't think was raised sufficiently by the applicants, who Terry Jean Bedford and the other applicants in the case, was the focus was really on common body house and moving everything indoors, and there was less focus on how striking down a communicating provision really benefits sex workers who continue to work on the streets. So I thought the interveners brought really made it clear that the communicating provision needs to be struck down as well, and that would benefit sex workers on the street because it would enable them to screen. One great point that Katrina Pacey's team brought up, and she's the lawyer for the sex worker organizations out in Vancouver, was that bad date lists are really important for sex workers' safety. And she said, if you have a bad date list and you can't even screen a client in a car to see whether they match the description of of one of the bad dates that is on this list, that can mean the difference between life and death. And I could sort of see the judges nodding, and I'm hoping that they really pick that up. I'm not sure because, they don't never really make their hand clear what they're going to do, but they seem to sort of to be really taking that in.
I also talked to Amy about the difference between legalization and decriminalization.
Well, legalization, like some rural counties in Nevada and Amsterdam, still views sex work in a negative light, needing heavy government regulation. A lot of the time, this regulation, no, not a lot of the time, almost all the time, if not across the board, sex workers are not at the forefront of that,
right,
the regulations that affect our work. So, there's red light districts, there's mandatory forced health checks, there's heavy licensing fees to open a place. So let's say myself and a bunch of people wanted to work together and we wanted to open a brothel or co-op space. The licensing fees are very high, so that limits who can get the licensing fees, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who are the ones that are opening the brothels, right? It's usually not the sex workers.
Right.
So a legalized model still views us as needing, as a vice, still needing heavy regulation. And decriminalization, the removal of the laws and what they've done in New South Wales, Australia, and New Zealand is rational regulation that makes sense and that people come to a consensus about, right? Sex workers being at the forefront of that discussion.
A lot of feminist organizations have also been pointing towards the Swedish model, where only the purchasers of sexual services are criminalized. Sandra spoke to why this model is still problematic for sex workers.
Because one of the interveners talked about the Swedish model, And the Swedish model, for those that you, who don't know, is when the clients are criminalized, but not the sellers of sex, but not sex workers themselves. And you're still prohibited from operating a common body house or living on the avails. Those provisions are still intact, but